So today, Bezras Hashem, we're going to look at specific Rishonim and Achronim on the topic of Bechiras Yisrael, which we've already been talking about. We're going to start with Kuzari, move to the Rambam, then I hope Maharal and Rav Kook, all of whom dealt with the issue considerably. So as opposed to what we've been doing the last couple of weeks, where we've been focusing more on the general topic. Today we'll look at specific Rishonim. I should point out at the beginning two things. Number one is we're going to we should keep in mind that this topic is a complex topic, and it's one in which the modern perspective is sometimes significantly at odds with the Torah perspective. At the same, and therefore our goal is to understand what is the Torah perspective on this topic. And for that, we look at Torah sources and especially the Rishonim. At the same time, there is machlokas, and as we've seen last time, there isn't always one clear-cut view. So our goal is to try to understand the different positions, and while we are not necessarily going to come out with a psak lahalacha, because psak would be inappropriate in this type of thing, we will get, perhaps to some degree, an impression as to which views are perhaps a little more mainstream and which are less so. So as I said, we're going to start with Bechira, with the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. We'll see that his perspective is certainly informed by earlier sources, but he was also a Mechadesh. Some of the things that he says were controversial. This is a major aspect of his Sefer, and without a doubt, his perspective on Bechiras Yisrael is something that will have a tremendous impact upon the thinkers that follow him. Ad Hayom Hazeh, we'll see echoes of his position in the Maharal and in Rav Kook and the like. And so it's particularly important to spend the time to really try to understand what he says, and then to see what aspects of this thought were became more mainstream, and perhaps which ones didn't. The Book of Kuzari is actually, that's not officially the book. I think it was written in Arabic, and the literal translation of the title was the Book of Argument and Proof in Defense of the Despised Faith, which tells you a little bit about the environment in which he lived in. And the book is it's based on a story that reached Spain. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lived in Spain. This story reached Spain in the 10th century, but took place in the 8th century. And the story was that the Khazar people, they lived in the shores of the Caspian Sea, and according to legend, the king dreamt the same dream as his general, and they were told, your way of thinking is pleasing to Hashem, but not the way you're acting. And this dream stirs something within this king, and so he decides to convene a debate. Originally, the Jewish position wasn't sought, for obvious reasons, like why would anyone even consider converting to Judaism? It was a despised faith. The Jewish people didn't have a country. So he convenes a debate with an Aristotelian philosopher, someone who represents Christianity and someone who represents Islam. Eventually, the Jewish sage is sought. He's called the Chaver. And the reason is because the king says, well, listen, if Islam and Christianity are rooted in Judaism, it would make sense to actually invite a Jew. The king then discovers the correctness of Judaism and converts. That takes place at the beginning of the second book of the Kuzari. And then the conversation continues for five books in total until the Chaver announces his departure to Eretz Yisrael. So the story, the concept, the story of the Khazar's conversion is something that's true, I think. But the dialogue that the Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi made up to express the debate isn't true historically, meaning to say this story, the statements that people are saying never happened as far as we know. But this is rather, this was a way in which the Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi was able to describe the basic views of Judaism, and it because it's in a conversation form, so it reads in a more gripping way, and it's a very, very important Sefer Machshava. Though around YU, it's not something that's studied all that often. So, before we begin talking about the question of Bechiras Yisrael, we're going to have to introduce it with a more basic question, which is, why is it that we should serve God in the first place? And the king says that the essence of our obligation to serve God is rooted in the personal revelation that we all experienced at Sinai. So if you take a look over here, I'm going to read it in English. Not that this is a great translation, but Hebrew is also a translation, and just to keep things moving. The translation that I got is there might be better translations, but I took the one that's from Sefaria. That which I am, so this is from Mamar Aleph, section 25. That which I am obligated in, and the entire congregation of Israel is obligated in, which was clarified to them at that event, which their eyes sight, with their eyes sight, and afterwards, the continuing tradition, which is equivalent to something one witnesses with their own eyes. This is very famous that the Kuzari talks about how we know of the truth of Torah, because unlike other religions that were rooted in the experience of a single person or a single prophecy or maybe a small group of people, Torah is rooted in mass revelation, something that we all experienced and then carefully made sure to pass down from one generation to the other. So the king asks, well, if that's true, does that mean that only Jews need to serve God? Because after all, I didn't, or my ancestors didn't experience that revelation. So what obligation do I have to serve God? See, right, the king says, if so, then your belief is confirmed to yourself. And the Chaver responds, yes, but any Gentile who joins us unconditionally shares our good fortune. So you have the opportunity to convert without, however, being quite equal to us. In other words, even after a ger is misgayer, they're not the same. Now, this is what I mentioned, or one of the things that I alluded to before, that the Kuzari's position is not necessarily the mainstream view. And we'll talk about why there are those that argue with him, why they do. But the Kuzari understands that even though obviously halachically when someone is misgayer, they are equal to a Jew. However, their neshama is a little different, and therefore they're not capable of achieving the same thing. And we'll see in a moment what he's referring to specifically is prophecy. Let's read on. If the law were binding on us, meaning to say, if the Torah was binding on us because he led us out of Egypt and remained attached to us because we are the treasure of mankind. Okay, so what does this mean? What is he getting at over here? So he's saying that we had this special bechira, we had this special revelation, and that's the basis of our special relationship. So the king is offended by this. You know, when he says we're the school of Mikol Ha'amim. So the king says to him, Jew, I see you regressing in your statements, and your words are poor after having been so pleasant, right? It's not so nice to be told this. So the Chavir then justifies the distinction between the Jew and the non-Jew by looking at the hierarchy in nature. It's very interesting. So he says, you know, we all know that there is this hierarchy. There's mineral, plant, animal, man. And the Chaver, the king, agrees to this categorization. He understands that there is differentiation. And then the Chaver asks the king, is there anything above man, right? There's Tzomeach Chai, Domeim, Adam is on top, but anything above man. And the king says, no, there's no such thing as anything above man. Man is the pinnacle. And then the king goes ahead, we'll see over here, and basically he describes Moshe Rabbeinu. And the question is, so what is the relevance of this? So let's read it inside, or outside, whatever. So the Chaver says, if we find a man, this is in 141, if we find a man who walks into the fire without hurt, or abstains from food for some time without starving, on whose face a light shines that the eye cannot bear, who is never ill nor ages, until having reached his life's natural end, who dies spontaneously just as a man retires to his couch to sleep on an appointed day and hour, equipped with the knowledge of what is hidden as to past and future, is such a degree not visibly distinguished from ordinary human beings? So the king says, of course, that's the level of an angel, if it exists at all. In other words, it has nothing to do with human beings. And the Chaver says, one second, these are some of the characteristics of Moshe Rabbeinu. So what is he getting at with this conversation? Moshe Rabbeinu's level is certainly categorically different than the preceding four levels. But how has this answered his question? So what the Chaver seems to be doing over here is he's establishing that there's a fifth rung in creation, and that is the level of a prophet, of which Moshe was the highest. Now, what does that have to do with the thing that the question which he's trying to answer? He's trying to answer how the Jewish people are distinct from the rest of the world. And what Rabbi Halevi seems to be doing over here is saying that only Jewish people experience prophecy. And while not every Jew may actualize that potential, every Jew whose ancestor experienced the revelation at Sinai has that potential for prophecy, and therefore is categorically different. In other words, in a certain sense, what he seems to be saying is, yes, there's a fifth rung in the hierarchy of creation. There's mineral, plant, animal, human, and Jew. And what distinguishes the Jew is what the Kuzari is going to call the Inyan Eloki. Inyan Eloki is something, the term that's very hard to define. Sometimes it's translated as the divine influence. It's something which allows for prophecy. And right now, we're not going to try to translate it any further, but we'll see in the upcoming sections how exactly he uses this. But the Inyan Eloki is some type of shaychus to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that a Jew has, which, among other things, is what allows for the possibility of nevuah. Okay, so we still have a lot to see, but if you want to ask some questions now, you can. Yonatan.
Simply the Bilam?
Yes, Bilam is a good kasha, and we'll have to see how he addresses that. And we'll see also, I hope, today, a little later, what about the Rambam? Shita, the Rambam does seem to disagree with this. He seems to say that his prophecy is shaykh to non-Jews. And so we'll address that as well. Though, interestingly enough, even the Rambam doesn't think that Bilaam's prophecy was necessarily true prophecy. So we'll get there. Bezus Hashem, Zev.
Yeah, but I feel like if you're trying to prove that the Jews are the ones who are higher than everyone else, why would you choose a prophet? I mean, choose like a regular Jew. Don't choose someone.
Good. So that's exactly the question we need to address, which is, how has he really answered the question? And to put it a little differently, what does that mean in a post-prophetic world? So let's spell that out. Nowadays, none of us are prophets. So does that mean that there is no longer anything different between a Jew and a non-Jew? Why is prophecy so fundamental? Or, to put it a little differently, what does the Inyan Eloki mean in the post-prophetic world? Is it no longer relevant? Or is there something else, some other manifestation of this Inyan Eloki, which only Jews have in the post-prophetic world? So let's try to understand it. It would be strange to say that, it's been more than 2,000 years since we've had prophecy. So does that mean there isn't any significance for the Inyan Eloki any longer? So I think if we consider the matter, we could sort of clear the Chakira, we could consider two possibilities, and the question is which one is right. One is that prophecy should be seen as an expression of a broader phenomenon, namely relating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu spiritually. The Inyan Eloki allows a person to experience HaKadosh Baruch Hu not just through rational experiential means, which, as we'll see, is something that is shayach for the whole world, including non-Jews, but rather through some type of inner sense, something else. So if that is correct, so then the Inyan Eloki is still relevant even in the post-prophetic world. Maybe prophecy is the most extraordinary manifestation of the Inyan Eloki, but it's something that's still shayach bizman hazeh. That's the first option. The second option is no. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi focuses on nevuah narrowly, which is why he always alludes to or refers to or addresses nevuah. And therefore, perhaps in Achanami, in the post-prophetic world, the Inyan Eloki isn't so significant. Of course, we long for the restoration of prophecy, and we very much hope that prophecy will be restored soon. But at present, actually, other than in terms of the future, maybe, there isn't so much relevance to the Inyan Eloki. So what's the pshat? So on the one hand, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi does seem to stress prophecy almost to the exclusion of other phenomena, which supports the second option. On the other hand, prophecy had long since vanished when the Kuzari was written, and it seems like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi didn't mean to say that the whole Inyan Eloki is no longer relevant, which would support the first option. It's interesting, just Agav, he talked about the Mile of Moshe Rabbeinu. And so you could ask, like, okay, but Ma Inyan Moshe Rabbeinu to me. So an interesting answer might be, this reminds me, I guess, of a halacha in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch writes that even though technically speaking, it's permissible to nurse a baby from a non-Jewish nurse. But if you take a look in Yeridaya, Simon Pei Aleph, Siv Zayin, the Rama writes that it's better that to make sure that your baby only nurses from a Jewish woman. What's the source of this? So the Vilna Gaon points out that we learned this from Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu refused to nurse from anybody else besides someone who was Jewish, that the mouth that was asid l'dabei mashchina couldn't nurse from a mitzvah. So the fact that this halacha is paskind in Shulchan Aruch, something that, you know, we should all strive for, points to the fact that we have to all raise our children with the hope and expectation that they will be the next Moshe Rabbeinu. And even if right now, you know, we don't have prophecy, that's something that very much relates to how we, how our hopes, aspirations, and expectations about our own children, as well as the world in general. So what do we have any rayos from the Kuzari itself? So I want to read with you two things that he says. The first one, this is from Maimer Beis, Perek Chaf Ches. And this is an extraordinary thing. In this passage, Rabbi Yehuda Levi describes the state of the Jewish people in Galus. And he compares them to the dried out bones in Yechezkel. Remember, Yechezkel goes out to this valley and he sees a field full of bones, dried out bones. And this is what the Kuzari says. So again, I'll read it in English. He says, the Chavar says like this. It is true that the source of wisdom, the Aser Sedibros, rested in the Aron, and the Aron is analogous to the heart, not the head. The Aser Sedibros were broken into 613 mitzvos, which is why the Torah also was next to the Aron. However, from there, two wisdoms emerged. The wisdom of the Torah and its sustainers, they were the Kohanim, and the wisdom of prophecy and its sustainers, the Nevi'im. These two groups of people became cognizant advisors who exhorted and reminded the nation. They then represent the head of the nation. So very interestingly, we have the head and the heart, the Nevi'im and the Kohanim. Says the king, if so, it would seem that today you are a body without a head and a heart, right? We don't have Nevi'im anymore. And we don't, I mean, we have people that are genealogically Kohanim, but they're not playing the role of Kohanim. A Kohen doesn't really play a different role than any other Yid. So the king says, so what's going on here? You're like a body without a head and a heart. And the Chavar says, yeah, Taka, what you're saying is right. Moreover, we have no real bones, just scattered bones, like the dried bones that Yechezkel saw in a vision. Nevertheless, these bones have some remnant of life in them, for they were once utensils for the head and heart, life, force, spirit, and soul. They are therefore better than the intact bodies whose head, eyes, ears, and the remaining parts are made of stone and plaster. In other words, dried out bones are still better than a statue that has its head and the heart, because the statue is never alive, nor will it ever live. And these dried out bones were once part of a living being and will once again, as in the vision of Yechezkel, become alive. And I think if we just had this, we would say maybe the second aspect that we said, the second option that we said before is correct, right? I mean, this is a shocking thing, you know, describing the Jewish people in Galus. What are we like? We're like this dried out bones. And it's shocking. Like, I don't know. I don't feel like I'm dead. Okay. I understand that we're missing Nevuah. and there's a lot of things we're missing. There are mitzvot that we can't do, but I don't feel like I'm dead. And what Rabbi Yehuda Levi is saying is that's maybe because you don't know what it's like to really be alive. But to compare the Jewish people in their current state to what they once were and what they will once again be is like comparing dried out bones to a living human being. So maybe actually the second option, that without nevuah, really there isn't something so special. It's only about our past and our future, maybe is correct. But when we read on, we'll see that that's not so simple. The king notes that this pedigree does actually allow us to maintain our distinction throughout the long and bitter galus. So the king says, this is true. It is inconceivable that any other nation would be able to retain its identity in exile without eventually being assimilated into its parent culture, and certainly not after such a long period of time. Look how many nations who arose even after the Jewish nation have been lost to history without even a memory remaining, including Edom, Moab, Ammon, Aram, maybe it's just Aram, the Philistines, Chaldeans, Medians, Persians, and Yavan, and more and more and more. So, right, what gives the Jewish people this longevity? So that surely is what we're describing. And the king takes note of the extraordinary Jewish history. And the Kuzari continues in saying it's not just our ancestry, but it's our hopes for the future. So the question is, where does this leave us? First of all, I think it's something, you know, when we think about Tzipisel Yeshua and we think about what we are longing for and what we're davening for, it gives us a better impression of what we're missing. That metaphor that he uses of the dried out bones is nothing short of extraordinary. Because again, I think sometimes we think of the coming of Mashiach as just, you know, more or less the same thing as we have now. But we'll be in Eretz Yisrael, we'll have, you know, autonomy, you know, our enemies won't persecute us, things like that. What the Kuzari is saying is that there's going to be a fundamental change and a fundamental shift, and the restoration of Nevuah is not like a minor thing. It's fundamental. But where does that leave us now? Does that mean that we're just these dried out bones longing for Geula? There's nothing left of our singularity. So the Kuzari continues and says, no, it's not so simple. And here's where he brings in the role of mitzvos. And of course, mitzvos are something that we have now. So he says, the Chafer says, do not think that because I conceded to your words earlier, meaning say I agreed that we're like a body without a head and a heart, this means we are like a dead object. Rather, we are attached to the divinity by the way of mitzvos, through which God made a covenant between us and him. There is bris milah, there is Shabbos. These are all called a bris. So what he's saying here is that through these covenantal mitzvos, we continue to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even in the post-prophetic world. Later on, at the end of the book, in the fifth book, he once again turns to the significance of mitzvah observance, and he talks about, I'll just read it, the fourth principle for understanding and observing Torah expresses the conviction that existing beings are made of higher or lower degree. Everything that is possessed of feeling and perception is higher than those creatures which lack the same. So again, he's turning to the hierarchy in creation. Since the former are nearer to the degree of the prime cause, who himself is intellect. The lowest plant occupies a higher rank than the noblest mineral. The lowest animal is higher than the noblest plant. The lowest human is higher than the noblest animal. Likewise, okay, and this is what's relevant for us, the lowest follower of the Torah occupies a higher place than the noblest person without mitzvos. For the Torah confers something of the nature of malachim on human beings, a thing that cannot be acquired otherwise. So here he's saying something very important. He's saying that actually Shmiras HaMitzvos is, you know, he's almost like saying the same type of thing as he said at the beginning of the Sefer, but replacing Nevuah with Mitzvos. So he's using the same mashal, the same hierarchy, that there's five rungs of creation, but in the fifth rung, instead of sitting the Navi, it's the person who observes mitzvos. The proof, he says, is that prolonged practice of halacha leads to a degree of prophetic inspiration of which there is no nearer degree to God for man. An observer of mitzvos that sins is therefore greater than one who lacks mitzvos, because the divine law empowered him to lead an angelic life. In other words, that fifth rung, which is shayach to, you know, which is above standard humans, is something that mitzvos allow a person to reach. And not just observance of mitzvos, but shaychus to mitzvos. And even if sin, if his sin sullied and defaced his stature, some traces always will remain. And the fire of his longing for it is not quite extinguished. If he had his own choice, he'd prefer to remain untutored, just a sick, pain-plagued person would prefer not to be a horse, a fish, or a bird, which, though happy and free from pain, is far removed from things that bring near to divine degree, right? So a person might be very sick, might be in a lot of pain, but they'd still rather be a sick human than a healthy horse. And the same thing over here. The person who doesn't keep the Torah is a sick Jew, but still he's on a different madriga. So that's what he seems to be saying over here. Now, what's fascinating is, again, in this section, he doesn't stress the Inyan Eloki like he stressed earlier. I don't think, though, that there's a stira here or a chazara. The pshat is that in the earlier passages, he was talking about the potential for nevuah, and here he is explaining how that potential is actualized. And the way it's actualized is through dikduk b'mitzvos. And he explains ad kedei kach that observance of mitzvos bring a person to a degree of ruach hakodesh. So they're linked. In other words, mitzvos lead to prophecy, but he's essentially describing two issues: who can achieve prophecy and how could a Jew perfect themselves? And they perfect themselves through mitzvos, and the ultimate goal might be nevuah, but there's still something distinct, even if that madrega is never reached. He does stress this again and again. I'd like to add something here, and then we'll maybe return to our question. Yehuda Levi also says that the possibility of meaningfully connecting to God, even without nevuah, exists. Meaning to say, and this is relevant both for the ger or the guy, even though the ger and the guy, according to his understanding, aren't shaykh to nevuah, but he says that they are shayach to be chachamim and chasidim. This is in Aleph Kuf Tes Vav. And that certainly is true in the post-prophetic world, even if we're not capable of achieving the madrega of nevuah, but we can be chachamim and chasidim, which is certainly no small accomplishment. So let's try to figure out what comes out from this discussion. So certainly, Rabbi Yehuda Levi believes that our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is severely weakened bizman hazeh. We can do mitzvos, and that's very significant, but we're also a shadow of our former glory. We're not at the level of a corpse, but like a sick person who's wasting away. And the doctors give up hope, but there's still hope for a nace. And that's what Yechezkel describes. Yechezkel asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu, can these bones live again? And the answer is, yes, they can. So you know, I think that before we asked the question, we were trying to answer Zev's question, you know, we presented two extremes. And I think maybe it's something in between. On the one hand, in Galus, we continue to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through mitzvos. At the same time, what we're lacking is very, very significant. So that is the idea of the Inyan Eloki. So now what we need to do is go back and try to figure out how did the Jewish people get this Inyan Eloki and how are they different from the rest of humanity? So let's take a look at what he says here. So the Kuzari presents a history of humanity. He starts off with Adam HaRishon, and he says, Adam had the Inyan Eloki, he was perfect in every way because Hashem created him directly and fashioned him according to his own design. And he says something very interesting over here. He says that because he was created directly from Hashem, so there's no restraining influence because of the seed of his father and mother. There was no issue of nutrition or education, and there was no issue of climate, water, and soil to consider with. In other words, what he's saying is Adam was perfect in three ways with respect to his soul, his intellect, and the Inyan Eloki. All humans possess the first two of these elements, but with respect to the third, it's limited. And it's almost like a quasi-genetic, the way he describes this. So not all of Adam's children received this Inyan Eloki. There was inferiority in this respect, which is actually what incited Cain to kill Hevel, he says. So then Shais, Adam's third son, does inherit this Inyan Eloki from Adam. And he continues that in subsequent generations, certain people got it, like Enosh, Noach, Shem. They also had this Inyan Eloki, but sometimes it skipped generations. In the case of Avraham, I think he said Aver. He was the first since Aver to actualize this Inyan Eloki. And even Avram Avinu, not all of his children followed in this path. So the Inyan Eloki only passed to Yitzchak and then to Yaakov. At that point, the Kuzari says something changed. Something changed. And a new era began in which everybody, all of Yaakov's children, lived up to that, and therefore they all got it. However, he says that even among the Jewish people, not all the descendants were tzaddikim, he says, but they could still pass it on. Because, you know, they could pass that Inyan Eloki onto their children. And so he uses a mashal. He says that, you know, we could compare it to the seed and the shell. The seed of the fruit is significant, because it could pass on that spiritual potential to the next generation, whether or not every generation actually actualizes that prophecy, that potential. So he gives a mashal. You could have this great seed, prize seed, but it might not produce great fruit. Why? Let's say you don't water it properly, or it doesn't get enough sunlight, these environmental factors. So, but it could still pass on that genetic superiority to its descendants. And so its descendants can produce that perfect fruit. And that's sort of the way that he says, you know, that's what happened. So what he says here, again, it's a bit hard to understand exactly, but he's saying that not every fruit is going to fulfill its potential. There are a lot of factors, but there could be this inyan eloki. He says that Avraham Avinu wouldn't have gotten that inyan eloki unless it was dormant inside Terach. So Terach never actualized that potential. He could be compared to that not ripe fruit, that not tasty fruit that's carrying this special seed. And again, he actually makes these comparisons to biology. So what changed after Yaakov Avinu? So after Yaakov Avinu, all the descendants got this seed. That ability for greatness was passed on to all of his descendants. Again, it doesn't mean that everybody is perfect among the Jews, but they all have that potential to do that. Okay, so that's the basic idea of how it happened. And that was because all of Yaakov's children were righteous, and so therefore Hashem gave that, as opposed to Avram and Yitzchak's children, so that ability to pass on Inyan Eloki was given to all of Yaakov's children forever and ever. So that's why every Jew, every somebody born Jewish at least, has that potential. That's what he writes. Now, I think that this concept of like comparing it to genetics is a little, might rub us the wrong way. And it's important to keep in mind something else the Kuzari writes, which is free will. And, you know, the Kuzari writes that anyone talks about free will in book 5, section 20 and on. And he says anyone who denies free will is basically a big hypocrite. Of course, he believes in omnipotence and omniscience, but success and failure are our choice. So what does that have to do with Inyan Eloki? And it seems that his answer is that the Inyan Eloki, even when you inherit it, is like we said, is not automatic. It's something that could be actualized, but is not automatic. Fine. So then the Kuzari says, so why did the Jewish people, why were they zocha to Mamad Har Sinai? So he discusses this again at length. This is in the third book. I'll take your question in 1 second, Zev. But he writes that Hashem created a world where people would have the freedom to choose whether or not they want to serve God or not. And when they choose to serve God, so then the divine light rests on them. When an entire family chose to serve God, like Yaakov's children, so then they're all zocha to it. And that's what happened at Sinai. Now, the big question I think that we need to think about here is, why is there a need for this hierarchy? Why is there a need for there to be two classes of people, those with Inyan Eloki and those without Inyan Eloki? Why couldn't it just be that, you know, everybody, every human being has this Inyan Eloki, and if they decide to actualize it, so then they'll be great, and they could even achieve nevuah, and if not, not. In other words, for the Kuzari, we have this concept of this inyan Eloki, and like we said, it's almost like it's genetic. It's not automatic, because even if you inherit the inyan Eloki, you have to actualize it, but lamaisa, not everybody has it. And nowadays, it's the Jews that have it. And the question is, you know, why do we need this division? Why didn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu give everybody free will? So I'll give everybody the potential, and if they choose to actualize it, then good for them, and if not, not. Right? Why does he need to set up the system this way? So the king actually asks him this question. This is in Book 1, Section 102. Why didn't he give everybody equal opportunity? Right? Doesn't, you know, it seems unfair that it should be determined, you know, why by my genetics. So that's his kasha, the king's kasha. So the chaver answers like this: would it not have been best for all animals to be able to speak? Right? In other words, why is there any hierarchy? Everybody agrees that human beings are higher than animals. So why? Maybe we should give, you know, it's unfair that turtles can't talk. You apparently have forgotten what we said previously concerning the genealogy of Adam's progeny and how the spirit of divine prophecy rested on one person who was chosen from his brothers and the essence of his father. It was he in whom the divine light was concentrated. He was the kernel, while all the others were like shells. The sons of Yaakov were, however, distinguished from other people by godly qualities, which made them, so to speak, an angelic caste, each of them being permeated by the divine essence, endeavored to attain the degree of prophecy, and most of them succeeded in doing so. Those who were not successful strove to approach it by means of pious acts, sanctity, purity, and intercourse with prophets. Note that he who conversed with a prophet experiences spiritualization during the time he listens to his oration. So there's something there as well. And he goes on. So the Chavir doesn't actually answer his question, right? He alludes to the hierarchy that he spoke about earlier. What he seems to be saying is that hierarchies are part of creation. Humans are more intelligent than animals. And among humans, not all are created equally. Some are more intelligent. Some are stronger. Some are more athletic. Some have more musical talent. Different people are born with different proclivities, and should they actualize those proclivities, you know, not everybody, even if they practice a lot, will be, able to play in the NBA or able to be a mathematician or the like. That seems to be what he's saying. We're not born on an equal playing field. And he says, likewise, some people are born with a higher spiritual capacity. And that's what he's saying. So that's the idea of the Inyan Eloki. And he's saying that Jewish people are born with a neshama that allows them to achieve a degree of spirituality that not everybody is born with. And you could say it's not fair, but that would be the same thing as saying, well, it's not fair that some people are born with more athletic genes, or why it's not fair that humans could talk and rabbits can't. That is the nature of creation. He's basically saying that the universe, I think, requires different types of creations to perform different tasks. An ant shouldn't complain that they're not a monkey. It's not, you know, it's not unfair to say that a cat can't talk and humans can. And therefore, it doesn't make sense, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, that a non-Jew would protest that they don't possess the Inyan Eloki. And he then goes on to say that non-Jews also play a very important role. If you remember last week, we saw that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi compared the Jewish people to like the heart of a body. So the heart has a role and other organs have a role. And each organ has a specific task. And some of those tasks are life critical. There are other organs that are Eiver Shanashama Tluya Bahem. Their roles are very, very important. But the heart has a specific role. And when Hashem tells Avram Avinu v'nifruchu b'chal kol mishpachos ha'adama, he's alluding to that special role. So that's what he seems to be saying. So it's important that the Kuzari says that all humans can achieve a certain type of closeness or excellence to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they could serve God through all sorts of ways, through the Seichel, they could intellectually connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says even Chasidus is Shayach to every human being. But there's a certain way of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through prophecy, through the Inyan Eloki, that is only Shayach to Jews. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says it's something that you're born with. And if you actualize it, then you can. But if you're not born with it, it's not shaykh to you. You could still serve God in other ways. But that specific task is for Jews. And that's because of their relationship that Hashem has with them. And they got that, as the Torah always emphasizes, is an act of love, as we saw in the Pesukim last week. Love isn't always something that's rational, but could be explained. We can't use regular terminology, rational terminology, to describe the nature of love. But that seems to be what he's saying. Okay, I know there's a bunch of questions. Zev.
How does this work? I mean, does this mean that when the Rambam says everyone can be like Moshe Rabbeinu, that's referring only with regard like to Midos, but when it comes to the intellect, it's not that, if that's not true?
Okay, so let's take a couple of things. Number one is Rambam says everyone could be like Moshe Rabbeinu, and the Rambam is not referring to everything. For example, Rambam doesn't think that you can be a Navi like Moshe Rabbeinu, Lo kam b'Yisrael kamo she'od, and the Rambam writes, it's one of the Ikar Yemunah, that the Madrega of Moshe's prophecy was different than everybody else. Okay, so what does the Rambam mean? So he tells you what he means. He says everybody could be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. And what does he mean by tzaddik? Does he mean, it's not just Nevuah that the Rambam precludes. Rambam writes in Ranavuchim that not everybody's born with the same intellectual capacity. And we know that certainly for the Rambam, connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the intellect is particularly important. So what does the Rambam mean? What the Rambam means is that everybody could be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. And a tzaddik means someone who's given their tool, given what they take what Hashem gave them, and they maximize their potential. Every human being can maximize their potential, and therefore every human being could be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. Not a Navi, not even necessarily a Chacham, but a tzaddik. What does Hashem ask from us? What Hashem asks from us is to be a tzaddik. Hashem asks from us to take what we're given and utilize it to its full potential. And in that respect, everybody can be like Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, I was hoping to get to the Rambam today. Maybe we'll do it next week. I don't know. But the Rambam doesn't necessarily agree with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in all these respects. First of all, as we mentioned, the Rambam thinks Nevuah Shayach to Goyim. And second of all, the whole, the Rambam does not stress the anything like the Inyan Eloki, meaning to say this spiritual or metaphysical differentiation between the Jew and the non-Jew. So perhaps next week we could see how the Rambam understands Bechiras Yisrael. But both the Rambam and Rida Levi, I think, agree that every human being can be a tzaddik, and every human being can connect to Hashem in their own way. And that is, and could achieve even an extraordinary madrega. But again, according to Rida Levi, there is this differentiation, and the degree to which a Jew could connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a particular way is different than someone born without the Inyan Eloki. And that seems to be his main point. And the greatest expression of that is Nevuah. Okay, Avram.
Okay, I was wondering, you know, what about Gerim, who seem to have a proclivity towards this Inyan Elokus? How does the Kuzari deal with that?
Well, so I can't answer for him, but I will say a couple of things. Number one is, like we said before, they can't be a Navi, according to Reb Yehuda Levi. According to Reb Yehuda Levi, the Ger cannot experience Nevuah. So, if you had a counterexample, you could show me that there was a Ger that was a Navi, so then that would be a Pircha. If not, so then Gerim can indeed achieve incredible Madregos in Avodas Hashem, but again, according to Rebbe Levi, it's not the same. It's not the same. Now, I should point out that, as I said, not everybody agrees with Rebbe Yehuda Levi here. And I should point out as well that even among those who take the approach of Rebbe Yehuda Levi generally to Bechiras Yisrael, reject his conclusion that a ger can't achieve that madrega. Some argue that even though, yes, there's such a thing as a special Yiddish neshama, but when a ger converts, he gets a new neshama. And therefore, it's true, he might not have been born with that, but it's something that he acquires. Or alternatively, there's a theory that Rabbi Yosef Engel has in Bilyonei Ashas, where he writes that the people that become Gerim must have been born with a special neshama. And he brings an interesting raya. It's a Gemara in Shavuos, Daf Lamed Tes Amud Aleph. So the Gemara over there talks about Moshe, I'll just read it to you. Moshe Rabbeinu, Kshishbias Yisrael, Amr Lahen De'u, Shalom Da'atchem, Ani Mashbiaschem, El Al Da'as HaMakom, Ve'al Da'ati, Shenema, Velo Atchem, Levadchem, The Gomer, Ki Eis Asher Yeshno Pao. Okay, so this is, of course, the bris that takes place described in Parshas Nesavim. So then the Gemara continues. Ainly ala osana omden al harsinai doros habayim v'geirim hasidim l'zgayim minayim. How do I know that future generations, including geirim, are part of this bris? Talmud lomar ve'eis asher einanu poim anu hayom. So what this Gemara seems to tell us is that future geirim were also at Sinai. And what this teaches us is that the neshamos of the Gerim were also at Sinai. So anyone who does convert must have this special neshama. In fact, with this, he explains a different Gemara. The Gemara says that Gerim are sometimes suffer because they delayed converting. And he says, how could that be? Like, it doesn't make sense. You know, not everybody is supposed to convert. So the answer is no, because if you have that special neshama of the ger and then you delay, so that is wrong. So anyway, So as I said, there are those who disagree with the Guzari about this, but the Guzari himself held that this Madrega of Nevuah, which stems from the Inyan Eloki, is only Shayach if you got it from your parents. That's his Mahalich. Okay, well, once again, I've been foiled, and we didn't get as much done as I was hoping. I guess I spoke too slowly. But perhaps, Bli Neder, I'm going to think about what we should do next time. In the meantime, I would definitely suggest that the Kuzari is a sefer that everyone should consider learning. It is hard, not just the words, but I meant like sometimes he goes on tangents and he talks about things that might not be so interesting, and it's not systematic and organized always. But there are many important yesodos that come out from the sefer. Yes, Gabriel.
Thanks, Yav. I just had a quick question. Mm-hmm. One was, in learning it, is there a difference in Hebrew and English if it was anyways written in Arabic?
So the answer is no, if you have a good translation. So that's the question. If you're confident in the translation. So from the Hebrew, we have translations that were written in the Tekufa, the Rishonim. We have modern translations that we know are very good, like Rav Kappach. So you have to make sure that you have a good translation.
But the classic, like Feldheim, Hebrew-English one.
So the Feldheim one is interesting. The Feldheim one, which is written by Rabbi Daniel Korbiner or something like that.
Korupkin, I think.
Korupkin, right, yeah. Korupkin. So what he did, and I haven't read it thoroughly, he didn't just translate it, and I don't even think he worked from the original. I don't know that he reads Arabic. But what he did was he sort of translated the idea. It's not a translation as much as, again, my impression from looking at it briefly is, more of a restatement in different words. And that's something that's very useful because there is a gap between, the Kuzari, even if you have an English translation or Hebrew translation and Hebrew or English, but he speaks in a different language, if you get what I'm saying. And this is true oftentimes when you read Sifrei Machshava. Same issue exists with the Rambam and Mor Nevuchim. He's speaking a different language. And besides the translation, there's that, different types of terminology and things like that. So I think what Rabbi Korupkin tried to do, and that's very valuable, is he sort of rewrote it in modern, using, more relatable words and ideas. So I think that's that might be very useful. And I think that's very valuable because it opened up the Kuzari to populations of people that otherwise would not have either been able to or at least been interested in studying it. So I think that's something that's valuable. But when you do something like that, when you read something like that, it is important to keep in mind that these aren't Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's words, and not even in translation. So especially if you get to something that you're unsure about, it might be kedai to look it up. There's also something else that someone did, Rabbi Chatzkel Sarna, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Chevron many years ago. So he went ahead and he took the ideas of the Kuzari and he restructured the book more in a topical and organized fashion. And that's also something that makes it easier to use. And so that's another way that you can study the Kuzari in, I guess, a more user-friendly format. But again, even that, by changing the order, you're losing something. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was a Rishon, and the way he wrote made, there's a lot of, he had his own order in mind. So once you start playing with it, you're taking something away. But at the same time, if that's going to lead a person to actually be able to learn the Sefer and appreciate it, so that's something that is that's valuable. It's interesting, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, just to show the respect that subsequent generations had for him, not just in terms of his hashkafa, as I said, the ideas that we talked about today, even if the later thinkers don't use the same lashonos as Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and don't necessarily even agree about every single thing that he said, like we said about nevuah for Gerim, but his impact is huge. I was saying the respect you see that we have for the Kuzari, even in his halachic points. If you look at the famous kuntros of the Chazon Ish about the international dateline, so he really quotes the Kuzari and deals with it, because the Kuzari is probably the most direct source in Rishonim for dealing with the question of the international dateline, even though it's not a, strictly speaking, a halachic sefer. Certainly his, so as I said, his ideas have really had a huge impact on us. And when you look at, later Sfarim that we might have more likely to learn, whether it's like Maral or the like, you'll see a lot of the impact of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's thinking, even if these later some don't always use the same terminology or don't even fully agree with him. Yes.
Just one last question. Sure. So the idea that like physical attributes can be passed down genetically makes a lot of sense to like modern minds.
Sure.
So, but the Kazuri's claim is that spiritual affinity for something also genetic, that by virtue of being born in Jew,
I don't think it's necessarily genetic in the sense that it's in the genes. I don't think that's what he means. I think he means that too can be passed down in a way that resembles genetic models. Doesn't mean that it's physical, and it doesn't mean that there's a gene. It's not like there's a gene for Inyan Eloki in Yaakov's children. If somebody says to the Kuzari, look, we actually checked the genetic code, I think they, there are certain Jewish markers, but that, I don't think that means anything. And even if you say there are no Jewish markers, I don't think he would be bothered by that. I don't think he means that it's literally. I think he uses genetics as a model for where you see that idea. In other words, that's a concept that exists in the physical world that might have some type of parallel to the way this spiritual concept works. But just like, if a person goes to me and says, I don't believe in a neshama. And I say, why? He says, well, we did an MRI and an fMRI, and we have these great brain scans. And we looked and looked and looked, and we didn't find the neshama. So obviously such a person doesn't know what a neshama is. They're looking in the wrong place. It's not a kasha. So the same thing here. I don't think he means that it's genetic. I think he uses that as a mashal to help you understand this non-physical concept.
Thanks,
okay. All right. Everyone should have a lot of hatzlacha and a wonderful Shabbos. Baz Hashem, we'll pick up next week.
Rabbi. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Ready?
Yes.
I just, we were singing the mirrors last week.
Uh-huh.
Shabbos, and I basically something that Rebbe covered in a previous year. Uh-huh. Help you understand a bit of the Zemiras.
Let's hear.
I think in Baruch Hillel we sing
Mm-hmm.
So what are the words before that? And right? So if somebody's essentially there is somebody those are the words, right? So I originally I was struck with the question. Is it a chovas hayom? Or is it a mincha yishlucha? Mm-hmm. So essentially, I think that's what Rebbe explained, the dual nature of mitzvahs. It's a chova, but the way we approach them is as a mincha yishlucha.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Shagachavi, thank you very much.
Yeah, good Shabbos. Good Shabbos.